not yet come to virtue itself. We are in the introductory part of the discussion. I think next time it will be better when you have read the passages. Today it's just listening to something you are not familiar with, so you may be lost in some places. So this is just the introductory talk before the author really explains what virtue is, and then what is the meaning of the word sila, and what is virtue, and so on. So he proceeded in this order. So he first put questions, and then he give answers to these questions one by one. So the first question is, what is virtue? What is sila? And the answer is, it is the state beginning with volition, present in one who abstains from killing living things, etc. So when we abstain from killing living things, or abstain from stealing and so on, a consciousness arises in our mind, right? What kind of consciousness? Wholesome or unwholesome? When we abstain from it, wholesome. So together with that wholesome consciousness, mental states or mental factors arise. Among these mental factors, there is one which is called volition, chetana. So here the answer is, what is virtue? Chetana is virtue. So when we say virtue, we mean chetana. And chetana, which accompanies the type of consciousness which arises in our minds when we abstain from killing, stealing, and so on. For this is said in the Patisambhita. It is the name of a book, Patisambhita. It is, in our countries, we include this in the text, in the Sutta Pitaka. But actually, they are something like an appendix to the Sutta Pitaka. And the Patisambhita was not taught by the Buddha, but by the Venerable Sariputta, his chief disciple. And the commentator, the Venerable Buddha Gosa, had much respect for this book, Patisambhita. He quotes from this book very often throughout this book, his book, the Visuddhimagga. So what is virtue? There is virtue as volition, virtue as consciousness concomitance, virtue as restraint, virtue as non-aggression. This is what is said in that book, Patisambhita Magga. So in that book it is said, volition is virtue. Mental factors are virtue. Restraint is virtue. Non-transgression is virtue. So virtue can mean any of these things. Consciousness concomitant just means what? According to our understanding, cetasikas. So sometimes cetasikas are called virtue. Sometimes restraint. We have abstinences among the 52 cetasikas. You remember them? Right speech, right action, right livelihood. So they are called restraint here. And then there may be other restraints too. And virtue as non-transgression, and non-transgression is also called virtue. So you know volition. Volition arises with the consciousness when we abstain from something. Virtue as consciousness concomitant is the abstinence in one who attains from killing living beings and so on. Abstain from killing living things and so on. So here, consciousness concomitant means abstinences, three abstinences. So sometimes three abstinences are called virtue. So sometimes chetana is called virtue, sometimes three abstinences are called virtue. And then, in another way, virtue as volition is the seven volitions that accompany the first seven of the 10 causes of action. karma, in one who abandons the killing of living beings and so on. Now there are ten causes of action. That means abstaining from killing, abstaining from stealing, from sexual misconduct, from lying, from backbiting, from harsh speech, and from talking nonsense. So these seven, and then we'll come to the three later. So when the author says seven, he meant these. So when one abstain from killing and so on. So three misconduct by body and four misconduct by speech. So they are seven. These seven kinds of volitions are called volition here, or sila. Virtue as consciousness concomitant is the three remaining states consisting of non-covetousness, non-ill will, and right view. These three plus the seven mentioned above are called ten causes of, say, wholesome action, kusala. So non-covetousness, non-ill will, and right view or right understanding. Stated in the way beginning, abandoning covetousness, it dwells with mind, free from covetousness, and so on. Now, virtue as restraint should be understood here as restraint in five ways. There are five kinds of restraints mentioned in the sutras. The first is restraint by the rules of community. That means, rules of community really means rules for monks. So there are 227 rules for monks. So when a monk keeps these rules, then he has to restrain his bodily actions and speech or verbal actions. So there is restraint according to the rules of Patimokkha. Restraint by mindfulness. Mindfulness is sometimes called restraint. Restraint by knowledge. Understanding or knowledge is restraint. Restraint by patience and restraint by energy. Here in restraint by the Patimokkha is this. He is furnished, fully furnished with this Patimokkha restraint. Restraint by mindfulness is the he guards the eye faculty, enters upon restraint of the eye faculty. That is, when you see something, you try to just see it and not go to liking it or disliking it. So if you can just see it and avoid from avoid the unwholesome mental states from arising, then you are said to be restraining the eye faculty. In fact, restraining the eye faculty doesn't mean closing your eyes and not look at things. But you look at things, you see, but you do not get akusala from seeing. That is the restraint in the eye. So, in order not to be attached to things you see, or not to be upset by things you see, you have to keep mindfulness. So that is why mindfulness is called restraint here. And knowledge is also called restraint. The currents in the world that flow, Ajita, said the Blessed One, are stemmed by means of mindfulness. The currents here means akusala. So these akusala are stemmed by mindfulness. When there is mindfulness, they cannot arise. They are stopped or something like that. Restraint of currents I proclaim by understanding, they are damned. So by understanding, they are totally subdued or suppressed. So here, understanding is called restraint. And the use of requisites is here combined with this. That means use of requisites is also called restraint here. Now, use of requisites means, this is for monks. Monks have to use requisites with reflection, with understanding. That means whenever I put on this robe, I have to say to myself, or I have to make reflection, I use this robe just to ward off cold, to ward off heat, and to ward off bites by insects, something like that. And when we eat something also, you say, I eat and not for not to take pride in my strength, not to make myself beautiful, but I eat this just to be able to practice Buddha's teachings and so on. And also when we use the vihara dwelling place, we have to reflect that I use this just for get protection from heat and cold and so on. And when you take medicine also, I take medicine just to get rid of disease. So monks have to do this whenever they make use of these four requisites. And if there is no understanding or no knowledge, then we cannot do it. Therefore, the use of requisites is also called restraint by knowledge. What is called restraint by patience? This is, he is one who bears cold and heat. So we bear cold, and we are patient with heat, we are patient with thirst, we are patient with hunger, and that is called restraint by patience. Actually, patience itself is restrained here. And restrained by energy means he does not endure a thought of sense desires when it arises. That means you have to make effort, or you have to have energy to not to endure such thoughts. So when, as soon as such thoughts arise in your mind, you just stop it. And that is called here restrained by energy. Because without energy, you cannot do that. So you have to be alert, and you have to make effort to stop as soon as these thoughts arise in your mind. And purification of livelihood is here combined with this. Purification of livelihood is also meant for monks. So monks must have a very pure livelihood. That means monk must not work to earn money. Monk must not must not tell fortunes or read palms so as to get something from people. So if we do that, then our livelihood is said to be impure. So in order to have a pure livelihood, what must we do? We must go out for alms. So we must make effort. We must have energy. That is the only purity of livelihood for monks. So monks must not work to earn money, or monks must not ask people, say, to bring food to them. So they must go out for alms. I'm in a very different country, and so we monks cannot do that in this country, go out for alms. So now we have to ask people to bring food to the monastery. So purification of livelihood means you must depend on yourself. In the books it is said you must rely on your foot muscles. That means you walk and to collect food from house to house, and then return to the monastery. So this fivefold restraint and the abstinence and cleansement who dread evil from any chance of transgression method should all be understood to be virtue as restraint, and virtue as non-transgression, that is just non-transgression, not breaking the rules by body or speech, of precepts of virtue that have been undertaken. So once you take the precepts, you keep them, you do not break them. And precepts here are of body and of speech. Now, we must understand that sila has to do with bodily actions and verbal actions, not thoughts. You may think of killing a living being, but so long as you do not kill it, then you are keeping that rule intact. You are not breaking that rule. You may think of telling a lie to another person, But so long as you do not tell a lie, you are not breaking that rule. So the sila is to control the bodily and verbal actions of a person.
We have a precept which is do not harbor ill will. Don't.
Right.
How does that work?
It is included in samadhi in Theravada Buddhism. Now, samadhi is for control of mind, control of thoughts. Because just thinking something, something bad, does not constitute the breaking of rules, because these rules control the actions of the body and actions of the mouth or of the speech. So, although it is not good to have unwholesome thoughts, still, if you do not do it with your body or with your speech, then you are still keeping these rules. You are not breaking these rules. So in Theravada Buddhism, sila is for bodily and verbal actions, to control them. And samadhi is for control of mind. And panya is for eradication of mental defilements. Although it is not a precept in Theravada Buddhism, and non-ill will is the same as do not harbor thoughts of aggression or thoughts of hatred. Yeah. That is included in the three causes of actions of mind. And non-covetousness, non-ill will, and right view. Now they are included in the karma of mind. We have three kinds of karma: bodily karma, verbal karma, and mental karma. So they are included in the mental karma. Now, what is the meaning of the word sila? It may not be interesting to those who do not who are not interested in Pali. But now the word sila is explained here as meaning composing or upholding. So the word sila means composing or upholding. Composing what? It is either a coordinating, meaning non-inconsistency of bodily action, etc., due to virtuousness. Now, non-inconsistency really means non-scattering of one's actions. That means if we do bad actions, then our actions are said to be scattered, not coordinated. Yeah, I think scattered is better than inconsistency. Consistence means it must not be different from others or something like that, right? You are consistent means you do this thing always. It can be a bad habit.
Doesn't vary.
That's right. Yeah. But here it is mean not scattered. Your actions are not scattered when you have sila. And the other meaning is to uphold, meaning a state of basis owing to its serving as foundation for profitable states. Only when you have sila can you have wholesome mental states. So sila is something like upholding. So these are the two meanings of sila. For those who understand etymology, that means grammarians, admit only these two meanings. Others, however, comment on the meaning here in the way beginning. The meaning of virtue is the meaning of head, sila. The meaning of virtue is the meaning of cool, sidala. That is playing upon the word. You know, the Pali word sila is close to the word sira, and also close to the word sidala. So they may explain it in this way. But it is not accepted by the commentator here. And what are the characteristics, function, manifestation, and proximate cause of sila? I think you are familiar with these characteristics and so on. Whenever we have to understand something, we have to understand that by way of characteristic and so on. Only then do you understand this thoroughly. And especially when you practice meditation, you come to understand things sometimes by characteristic. That means you see the characteristic of it sometimes. Sometimes you see the function, sometimes you see manifestation, and sometimes you see proximate cause. So with reference to these four, we have to understand things. So sila is also to be understood in these four aspects. So what is its characteristic? That means what is its individual essence, or its nature? So the characteristic of it is just composing, the same as the one mentioned above. Just as visibleness is the characteristic of the visible database, even when analyzed into the various categories of blue, yellow, etc., because even when analyzed into these categories, it does not exceed visibleness. So also this same composing described above as the coordinating of bodily action, etc., and as the foundation of profitable states is the characteristic of virtue, even when analyzed into the various categories of volition, etc. Because even when analyzed into these categories, it does not exceed the state of coordination and foundation. Now, visible database means just the visible object. Among the 28 material properties, there is one thing which can be seen, and that is the only thing which can be seen by our eyes, and that is translated as form or visible object. Now, that visible object, the characteristic of that visible object is just visibleness, that it can be seen. So that is its characteristic. Although we can say that visible object is blue, yellow, red, white, and so on, they may differ in these aspects, but according to characteristics, they are only one. They are only one visible data, which is a characteristic of visibleness. So in the same way, we may describe sila as chetana is sila, chetasikas are sila, restraint is sila, non-transgression is sila. But however varied and different kinds of sila may be, the characteristic, the common nature of all different kinds of sila is just composing. So it has the characteristic of composing. And then, what is its function? Now here, the word function, or the Pali word rasa, has two meanings. One is action or function, and the other is achievement. Sometimes the function as action is used, and sometimes function as achievement is used. But here, both are mentioned. So what is the function of sila? Stopping misconduct. It is its function. So when you have sila, you do not break precepts, and so you do not do misconduct. So stopping misconduct is its function, functioning as is its nature. And blamelessness is its function as achievement. That means when you achieve purity of sila, then you are blameless. So blamelessness is actually the outcome of the purity of sila. So blamelessness is also said to be the function of sila. So the Pali word rasa has two meanings: function or action and achievement. And its manifestation. Now virtue, so say those who know itself as purity, will show, and for proximate cause they tell the pair, conscience and shame as well. Now, the manifestation of sila is just purity. When we concentrate on sila, it appears to us as purity. So sila is real purity. So purity is the manifestation of sila and virtue. And its proximate cause is conscience and shame. Its proximate cause is shame, actually shame and fear. There's shame to do wrong things, shame to do unwholesome things, and fear to do unwholesome things, because if your moral conduct is not pure, we'll get bad results. So this shame and fear, these two are called the proximate cause of sila. So long as people have this conscience and shame, or shame and fear, people will keep precepts. And the moment these two leave people, then people will do anything they like.
Can you define what proximate cause is?
There are two kinds of causes, a near cause and far cause.
Okay.
So it is near cause.
Near cause in the sense that this is what immediately gives rise.
That's right.
To.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. We've gone only 9 pages. So next week. I don't know how you can get each a copy of the book. Can you make copies of
it? Xerox? I suppose we could Xerox some of the pages.
Yes. So that they can read before they come to the class.
Downstairs in the reading room, there's at least one copy. Maybe I'll try to see that there are two copies on reserve there all the time. And I'll Xerox some. Maybe the first chapter.
Yes. So please read about 20 or 30 pages for next week. And after you read and you come to the class, and we can discuss.
So you didn't mention very much what the role of the Visuddhimagga was in studying in the Theravada countries, but I've heard that if you want to practice Buddhism, they often say you need two things. You need a cave and a copy of this book.
That's right. Yes. It's held in very high esteem in Theravada countries. It's next to the Buddha, actually. And this is the Burmese edition of the book in Pali. This is the first volume of the book.
Any other questions?
Yes. This time, maybe not many questions.
Hard to follow.
Is it mainly meant for the mass, or does it have any place for, ordinary folks like us?
Yeah. Now.
So what is the relevance?
Okay, the first two chapters you have to be patient with, because it deals with the practice. I mean, the rules for monks and practices for monks, but we can adapt some of the statements in this chapter and the next chapter to sila for lay people. See, monks are exhorted to be very strict in keeping their rules, not to have broken even a small rule. And it is said later on, we will find that seeing danger in the smallest the smallest transgression or something. So in the same way, if you're going to practice meditation, then you have to clear the basis. You have to establish a firm foundation of moral purity first. That means, as a layperson, you take precepts, at least 5 precepts, and keep them. So you are not to break any one of these rules. You are to keep them intact. And you may be exhorted not to break any of these rules, even though your life is in danger or something like that. So we can adapt the admonition or the advice given in this chapter to the practice of lay people too. But this chapter deals with monk behavior, monk sila, and I'm afraid you will find many improper conducts and resort mentioned here. So you'll know how monks are, what do you call, clever in acquiring things for them, and clever in talking, not direct lie, but something like, what do you call that? Yeah, something like white lie or something. So, and one thing good about these commentaries is they give many stories. So we can learn from these stories. So from the third chapter onwards, it's for those who practice meditation, whether you're a layperson or a monk. Although the emphasis is on the monks, because monks are those who practice meditation more than lay people. But it is no longer true. Lay people are also very interested in meditation now, especially in Burma. About the turn of the century, monks became interested in the practice of vipassana meditation, and also give chance to lay people to practice vipassana meditation. Formerly, lay people did not think that they could practice much meditation because they had things to do in the world. And even though you are a monk, if you want to practice meditation, then they think you have to go to a very secluded place and be there alone and practice meditation. But the teacher of my teacher, Mahasi Sero, the teacher of Mahasi Sero, was one of the pioneers of the rekindling of interest in the practice of meditation, both by monks and lay people. And I think he was the first who taught meditation to lay people, and who accept lay people to come to the monastery and practice intensive meditation like we do now. His personal name was Unarda, but he was known as Mingun Zidogun Seyaro. His name was mentioned in Nyanaponika's book, The Heart of Buddhist Meditation. Yeah. So now, many lay people practice vipassana meditation in Burma, and also in this country now people are very interested in meditation. So I think this is a good sign of a good trend Buddhism is going towards. Because after all, practice is what counts. Just understanding or just knowing theoretically will not help us much. We have to put this theoretical knowledge to practice. And the study and practice, I think, should go together. Just study will not help us much in understanding. And something you see through the practice of meditation helps you to understand, to have deeper understanding of what you know from books. So these two should go together, practice and meditation. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.